hypothesis at this point.
If you're using forest, the waste residue, does that promote clear cutting versus selective harvesting forest?
Not necessarily. I mean, there, a lot of folks, that's as a concern of the environmental groups that it'll promote it, but it's, you can, the stuff that we call biomass or logging residues or limbs and tops and trees that don't have any other commercial value, doesn't mean they don't have value for wildlife or something else. Well, you can glean those on any kind of a harvesting operation. We do have a developing energy market already in the state, even without this portfolio standard. And so we do have some loggers who are already supplying energy wood. And I'm working with one next week who is doing thinnings, partial harvest, and gleaning energy wood while doing partial harvest. So is it likely to promote clear cutting? Certainly it would facilitate it some. Will it result in more clear cutting? Probably depends on the objectives of the landowner.
And that's also going to stimulate a new industry or a potential new industry. We're also engaged in the department in developing new biomass woody crop species and using some traditional species like sweet gum and trying others like, say, cottonwood, things that are very highly productive that you could manage on a short rotation. So almost getting it into an agricultural type model. But again, all the issues of sustainability and water use and those kind of things need to be to be researched. And as you all know, this biofuels is very new on the horizon, and we're on the, you know, just at the beginning of doing this type of research. So,
okay, I'm going to be a pessimist and argue that if the cost of these kinds of programs become too great to the public, isn't it possible at least that the renewable energy budget and other kinds of activities like that can be turned around simply by votes of legislature? They created it, they can also cancel it or change it or back it off. So how much of this is dependent on legislators' continued support of this kind of program?
If you're talking about the renewable portfolio standard or the things that I talked about in here, the answer is all of it. I mentioned that we do have energy markets, and I can give you examples. In New Bern, there is a standalone energy plant that burns around 600,000 tons a year, sells electricity to the mid-Atlantic states. About two-thirds of that's wood. The other is municipal solid waste from Triangle area and poultry litter. And they're surviving without any incentives or anything else. So there'll be some of it, but if these massive tree planting programs or this renewable portfolio standard, the bill, as an example, has in it what a colleague of mine calls off-ramps. And so you can figure out what that means. So, yes, it could be easily undone. In fact, not trying to provide commentary, but within a month after the renewable portfolio standard passed, Governor Easley was quoted under the dome in the dome section as saying we made a mistake and it's too aggressive, we don't have the resource and we need to revisit it at the short session of the General Assembly. So sure, it can all be undone. And I'll add to that, if you're have an environmental interest, and we've got in some environmental groups, especially in the western part of the state, who are just don't like tree harvesting, especially clear cutting, but they're not fond of intensive forest management. If they in participating in this Environmental Management Commission facilitated process coming up, if their goal is to shut down energy wood harvesting and they're successful in having the EMC create a lot of regulation and on-the-ground practices that are required, at some point it's a low-value material, the loggers say it isn't worth it. That's another way that it could be undone. So,
with the rising fuel costs too, a lot of loggers are finding that it's hard to make a living just doing traditional forestry. So that's an additional part of the equation.
I have a couple questions. One, would you remind me the department that I guess spearheaded the renewable energy portfolio standard?
Well, it was, I'm not sure I can give you the, where was the question?
You had mentioned
right
the department.
There. Okay. Well, the
early on,
the Utilities Commission is the one, State Utilities Commission, who I guess in a sense introduced it. I'm not sure I'm correct in saying that, but it was introduced as a bill into the General Assembly. It was referred immediately back to the Utilities Commission for study, and then the next session, the General Assembly, once the studies were done, then the General Assembly considered it and passed it. Okay. But they're the ones who are responsible ultimately for anything with public utilities.
Okay. All right. My next question is, you said that, you know, something needs to be done today, not 12, 20 years. And so to bring it to a very micro level, is there a formula out there for an individual to calculate how much CO2 they produce in a lifetime and how many trees they should need to plant in a, you know, to,
oh, thank
to cover
you.
That?
I didn't do all these calculations for nothing today.
And is it accessible for us to?
Okay, to give you an easy answer to your question is, there is a very easy facility available on the internet linked to Al Gore's movie, Inconvenient Truth. So if you Google Inconvenient Truth, that'll take you to the website. And then there's actually a CO2 footprint calculator. And you can go in there and enter in the kind of cars you have, how many miles you drive to work, what kind of heat you have in your house, how old your house is, and all these factors. And it'll come up with an estimate of what your CO2 footprint is. And then it will compare that to the average American and find out if you're better or worse. I did mine, and I found out I was worse. So I was feeling very bad for about a year, which forced me to do these calculations. And that kind of brings in trees to the equation, too. So this is just an example of this that everybody can do and be conscious of in your daily activities. When you burn a gallon of gasoline, that releases 20 pounds, about 20 pounds of CO2 in emissions, just 1 gallon. So that's an amazing number. Of that CO2, you know, because of the one carbon and two oxygen atoms in that molecule, that's about 5.4 pounds of carbon, okay? We did a study in northern Michigan when I lived up there a couple years ago, and we did some analyses, very detailed studies of how much carbon was contained in trees and stands. And this was red pine growing up in Michigan, and the oldest stand of trees we harvested was 55 years of age. And that would probably be equivalent to a loblolly pine down here that was about 25 or 30 years old, so you can keep that in the back of your mind. And so in a stand, you know, that's managed just like any other of red pine, each tree contained about 400 pounds of carbon, okay, when you measure the amount of biomass in the roots and in the shoots, and then you figure they have about 50% carbon content, and then you do the calculations. It comes out to about, you know, in the average-sized tree on the landscape, they had about 400 pounds of carbon. And in the range around here, you know, because nobody lets trees get old anymore, they're always cut before they're, you know, 80 or 90 years old anyway. You might think that there's a range of up to 1,000 pounds of carbon per tree. And typically in forestry operations, by the end of a rotation, we like to have between 200 and 400 trees per acre. So if you add up all those 400-pound trees to either 200 or 400 pounds per acre, That gives you from 82,000 to basically 164,000 pounds of carbon contained in that stand per acre. And so I asked myself, well, what is that in gasoline equivalents? How many gallons of gasoline is that worth? And in the 200 trees per acre scenario, that's worth 15,000 gallons. And in the 400 trees, it's about double that, 30,000 gallons. Then I calculated my weekly mileage. I live in northern Johnson County, so I have a 29-mile commute. And I drive a Subaru Forester, and I get, you know, about 25 miles to the gallon. And I fill my tank up about 1.5 times per week. So on an annual basis, I burn about 1,040 gallons of gas, okay, just commuting into work. And so that's part of my CO2 footprint. Fortunately, my wife and I have 30 acres of regenerating hardwoods. And if using these numbers from a different forest type, but doing a back-of-the-envelope calculation, in 1 acre of land, if we have 400 trees per acre, that's equivalent to 29 years worth of CO2 emissions from my driving. So just by having a little bit of forested land, we're way more than offsetting our CO2 emissions due to driving. So I feel a lot better about myself now after having done this. So that's one example. Just maintaining as many trees on the landscape as possible, even though our forest ecosystems are not enough to pull down the CO2 concentration to what it was pre-industrial times, every little bit helps. And so there are things that we can do now. If there's trees in the landscape, leave them there. If they're not trees, plant some. In addition to the aesthetic appeal, they help reduce heating and cooling costs. That's another way. And eventually, we're going to heat our house with wood, as soon as we can afford to put a stove in. And we're going to get a Prius and all that. So, I mean, there's things that individuals can do. And, a place to start would be look at that CO2 calculator and see how you're doing relative to your colleagues. And
I have a quick question for Dennis. You talked about in the document that you're preparing for Secretary Ross that there are incentives for keeping trees in place. Specifically, what are those incentives for developers? Because it seems like in Raleigh in the last 10 years, developers cut down all the trees on a parcel and then they build large houses rather than leaving any.
That's correct. There are two types of incentives. One is an incentive in, any acre that we reach is a success story. But one is to provide more funding to some of the conservation easement programs, like the stewardship program, where landowners are willing to donate or forego some development rights. In many cases, landowners are simply willing to do that out of a sense of stewardship. But for other landowners, having that easement purchase makes a difference. So that's one type of incentive. But the urban incentive assumes that developers aren't going to leave anything. And so it's to incentive to work through the municipalities to pay for some large tree plantings post-building or post-home development, and also to tie those incentives to some agreements that they stay in, that the trees stay in place, and also where they're located with respect to, like, the HVAC unit, because you get an enormous difference if your unit itself, your outside unit, is shaded.
Isn't there also a regulatory mechanism, the city tree conservation ordinance, which was partially written by Ted Shear, who's a colleague of ours in the department? And I think that states that they have to leave 10% of the area in trees. But there are ways of kind of getting around that. If you're near a stream, the riparian buffer would count towards that 10%. So it's not perfect, but it's also...
I was really surprised to hear read in a recent National Geographic that when trees are cut, there's so much roots and so forth underground that they start actually putting out CO2, and it takes about 20 years for it to start taking in CO2 in a net way. And I'm wondering if you're actually advising people to leave trees in longer, and if you see any things done for homeowners to advise them not to cut down that sweet gum, but maybe leave it there instead of putting in some pretty little ornamental.
Well, yeah, I think the amount of carbon sequestered by a tree is proportional to the size of the tree. So if you have nice big trees, they hold more carbon than a crepe myrtle shrub. And you're correct, when you do cut a tree down, it does start decomposing, the root system start decomposing, and basically the system would go back into equilibrium with the atmosphere. There's always an equilibrium, a give and a take between the atmosphere and the forested surface, land surface. So when you do disturb a site, whether it's a commercial harvest of a forest or just cutting a tree down in your yard, part of that will decompose. And so that's true, yeah.
And I'll add something in terms of some complexity to part of that answer. Most of you, probably all of you, are aware that we are beginning to see some carbon markets develop in the U.S. In Europe, they're very vigorous markets because the country signed on to Kyoto over there. And I can give you one very real impact of how strong the market is. We're currently in the southeastern United States, including North Carolina, shipping. Well, the rule of thumb for hauling chips from the woods produced for energy is 30 to about 50 miles is as far as you can afford to haul them before the cost of the diesel for the truck overcomes the value of the BTUs of the chip. So it's a really low value product, and yet we are chipping logging slash and trees, and we're shipping them on ships to Italy out of North Carolina for electricity production over there. Well, how in the world is that happening? It's because of the vigorous European carbon markets, where you've got power plants in Italy that are receiving carbon offset incentives. They're basically taking up someone else's carbon, and they can afford to come all the way over here and buy chips. Well, we have very poorly developed carbon markets, but they're coming in the United States. Chicago Climate Exchange is probably the best known. Well, then comes the question, if you're doing a tree planting project for the purpose of taking up carbon, do you plant the trees and leave them there to soak up carbon, knowing, as John says, it's going to reach a point where it's sort of an equilibrium? Or do you harvest the trees and have some of that, you sort of start the cycle over, you may lose some from decomposing root systems? Well, the answer is, who knows where it's going to end up, but there have been some incredibly complex analysis that have been done called life cycle analysis, and the most complex life cycle analysis look at every energy and carbon input of the whole process. So for trees, they look at what it takes to grow the trees and the carbon it takes up. If the trees are harvested, you've got diesel fuel from the logging tractors and everything else, transportation, all that gets subtracted from the equation. But it turns out, if in the equation, so to speak, you include the fact that with a 2x4, you're displacing an aluminum 2x4, which takes an enormous amount of electricity to produce, or masonry block, which concrete is an enormous energy producer, that one of the best uses for carbon of forest is actually to manage the landscape, periodically harvest, take the low-value stuff, displace coal with biomass, and then take the solid dimension material and put it in a long-term structure. The analysis have said that's the best bet, but it's so complex, it's so hard to monitor if you're going to monitor carbon credits, but it's one of the issues the U.S. carbon markets are going to face. If we're going to give carbon credits to a landowner from growing trees, will they just stay there, or can they manage them? And that stuff's all up in the air.
Someone else next, or is this? I didn't know if someone else was next. I thought maybe there were two microphones. Sorry. To answer the question about the ordinance, the Raleigh tree ordinance is being updated right now. So if you are a Raleigh resident and want to go talk to the city council, I think you might have be able to have some input into that. It's interesting what you say about the waste on the site being used for biomass, because if that were not taken off the site, then its decomposition would be adding carbon dioxide or methane or whatever into the atmosphere. So actually cleaning it off is helping the carbon, but not helping the animals and the wildlife that live there. And then the other thing is, if there are incentives in that report you have, is there any way for developers to get the trees that they harvest off of a site or that they scrape off of a site to put development up to the place where it can become biomass rather than just burning it on site, which is what they generally do, which is releasing the carbon again, rather than getting it into a closed system where it's producing energy? And then the other question, all this is like, you know, like you said, it's a web that is difficult to measure. In Project Learning Tree, we learn that, I think it says in one of the lessons, that everybody should plant 65 trees to balance their lifetime carbon use. Is that still a viable number?
I would say the more the better. If you can plant 65, that's great, but plant, you know, 130 for your neighbor who doesn't plant. And then as far as the residues, the logging residues, and turning them into energy, the CO2 is going to get into the atmosphere whether you let it decompose on the forest floor or you use it for energy production. I mean, you'll be getting the energy out of it, which is an output and a benefit. But either way, the CO2 is going to eventually end up in the atmosphere. One of the keys to the biofuels thing is that it's not that you're not creating CO2 emissions, but what you're not doing is you're not releasing fossil carbon, and that's the key distinction. You're displacing fossil carbon emissions into the atmosphere. So really, the worst, in terms of the global carbon cycle, the worst thing we can do is what we've been doing for 150 years, which is taking this very stable, sequestered carbon, this geologic carbon that has been underground for millions of years, and we're releasing it into the atmosphere in a very short time. And, you know, the hope of biofuels is that we displace some fraction of that fossil CO2 emission. When you cut down a tree and you burn it, whether it's for a campfire to cook marshmallows and s'mores with your kids, or to put it in a biomass-fired energy plant, you're basically recycling carbon, current carbon, what we call current carbon. And so you're really, in my opinion, you're not having a big effect on the global carbon cycle, except that you would be displacing, if you use it for energy, you're displacing fossil CO2 emissions.
One of the terms that it is often used to describe the use of wood for energy is it's said to be a carbon neutral fuel, because the notion is John has said, that you're burning carbon, producing carbon dioxide, but then it gets recycled. But there is an important caveat to that. If you clear a tract of trees and convert it into a Walmart or whatever, the deal's off, because there isn't going to be maybe there'll be some scattered shade trees, but there will not be a vigorous forest to take up that carbon that was released. So it is important to maintain forest cover, establish forest cover on marginal croplands, and it's a big part of it.
Well, in addition to that, not only are you removing the sink for CO2, the trees, but also you're removing that reservoir, the soil that I talked about earlier. When you put the Walmart on there, eventually all that carbon that's in the soil is going to decompose. It's not going to be replenished because you've taken the forest away. And that's actually probably going to be the bigger source of carbon, is that disturbance of the soil. You know, it's been well documented that, you know, with the green revolution, when you convert a forested landscape to an agricultural setting, you lose huge amounts of soil carbon, and you don't get it back in an agricultural system. So that's a big part of the equation that people tend to overlook because it's underground.
Well, that's one of the things I was thinking about, was that it seemed to me that it would be better if you are going to harvest this scrap be to turn into something like wood or an engineered wood product, so that way that carbon is sequestered as long as that product till it decomposes rather than burning it and releasing it back into the atmosphere. And we would be better off just trying to go for energy conservation and other things like solar and wind power rather than burning wood, which is still going to release more carbon dioxide and more pollutants unless you have some really, really tight air emission standards.
I don't disagree. I mean, ultimately, the solution is energy conservation, but it's slow in coming.
Yeah, and the other thing with biofuels is we still lack, like Dennis said, we still lack a comprehensive life cycle analysis.
Right.
If you're in tune to the bioethanol debate, especially with corn, there's a debate whether the net energy yield is actually positive or not. Some people believe that you use more fossil fuels to create a gallon of ethanol than the BTUs that you get out of it. And if that's the case, then it's definitely not a good thing for the environment. On the other hand, again, when I lived in northern Michigan, another one of these personal analogies I have is I lived there for 8 years. The first four years, I lived in an old mining house, and I just heated with a forced air oil-fired furnace. And I burned about 1,000 gallons of fuel oil a winter, and I did that for 4 years. So, it's burned into my memory. Then I moved to a house that had a wood stove, and I got forest gleanings from the school forest that I worked for, and I heated my house with that wood. And for a couple gallons of gas to run the truck and the chainsaw, I heated the house for 9 months of terrible northern Michigan winters with wood. And so I displaced basically 1,000 gallons of fuel oil by using wood. So in some cases, in my opinion, again, a lot of the answer can be decentralization. If you reduce your personal energy impact, grow shade trees around your house, use solar panels on your house, if you can burn wood for heat, those kind of things collectively, if we all start participating in that, plant trees, I think can make a difference, an immediate difference too,
Okay, I'm very excited. We don't have 30 acres, we have 1 acre. What do we plant for the short term, for 5 years, whatever, to start helping?
I'll let you take that, John, since I don't know.
How many people are in love with their chem lawn, pure grass that has not a weed in it? And okay, so that's one thing. Good. So get rid of those. I mean, the things that you got to mow 3 times a week, and any high maintenance type of landscaping, like a grass, like a lawn, is, people in the NC State, crop science department,
turf grass.
Yeah, the turf grass people would hate me if they heard me talking right now, but. A nice grassy green lawn uses a lot of water, which, a lot of people had problems with last summer, and uses a lot of energy. Every gallon of gas you burn to mow your lawn, you're emitting 20 pounds of CO2 to the atmosphere. So if you can replace grass with trees and maybe have a multi-tiered system where you have some shade-intolerant trees that grow really fast, things that would, like a tulip poplar, a yellow poplar, very nice. They're really actually a very nice ornamental tree. They look nice, they have nice foliage, they have beautiful flowers, and they're one of the fastest growing trees we have in this area. And they're actually fairly disease resistant. So you could plant tulip poplars as your overstory, and then underneath the tulip poplars you could have redbud and dogwoods and beautiful native species that are shade tolerant. So you would get the carbon sequestration benefit from the overstory trees, the big trees, but you'd also get a benefit from the understory landscaping.
And that... One of our PhD students is doing a big analysis of a huge data set called FIA data, and all forestry people are familiar with it. But one of the things that he found is that on natural stands, the maximum standing biomass occurs where you have mixed species and diverse vertical structure. So I don't know how much you're going to try and maximize every cubic foot of atmosphere in your yard, but what John says in light of that does make a lot of sense.
Yeah, and it also, if it decreases the temperature of your structure in the summertime and helps insulate it or protect it from wind in the wintertime, those are the real energy gains that you have. And another thing I would add to the lawn thing is if you like to mulch your plants, so some people like to have mulch around their woody plants, don't use, you know, I would recommend that you don't use sphagnum moss from Canada or other northern boreal systems, because again, what we're doing, and this industry has been alive, and I know, I realize there are people that make their living off of this and depend on it, but the net effect on the carbon balance is you're taking this carbon that is sequestered in these northern wetland systems, and you're bringing it down here where it decomposes really fast, and you're blowing all that carbon into the atmosphere. So, again, people who do life cycle analyses are actually looking at the peat industry, you know, here and in Europe for that reason.
I got two. Can I have two?
You can have
one. Okay, one. Get to the point. Just looking in this building right here, and if you look around the neighborhood, everything is made out of wood. And that's very distinctive of America. Everywhere else is made out of stone or brick or mud. And the reason why is because wood is so plentiful in North America. And the reason for that is because we got onto the fossil fuel line. We got off of wood, which is what happened in everywhere else, and we got onto coal, and we got onto oil. So I guess I see that somehow we're living in a paradox. We have so much wood here, more than anywhere else, you know, in most developed nations around the world, and yet it's all fostered by fossil fuels. So how do you feel about that?
Well, that's a very good observation. And one of the big critics of the developing biofuels industry is a guy named David Pimentel. He's a professor at Cornell University, and he has done, and some of his colleagues have done, back of the envelope calculations, and they have basically estimated that the U.S. burns more energy from fossil fuels than the green plants on our continent fix two times over. So basically, we're using more energy than all the green plants, ag systems, forest systems, twice over. So biofuels can never satisfy our energy demand, number one. And you're right, the reason we do have, and they also cite the example that in the mid-1800s, when we were basically a wood-fueled society, there were wood shortages when the population was much less and our economic activity was much less. So again, that's an astute observation. That, you know, and really, I mean, our society, Western society, has been subsidized by what we would call a labile fuel energy source, a very easily utilized energy source. And society is starting to wake up to the fact that the party is almost over for a couple reasons. The fossil fuels are running out. And, you know, even if we burned every last ton of coal that we have, we really, if we put that much CO2 into the atmosphere, it's just scary to think what might happen. That's a great observation. And that's, you know, I think people in the energy business realize that it's going to be a mix of solutions, biomass, right, solar, wind, conservation is a huge one. And, you know, so we are, you know, vigorously searching for solutions.
That, I agree. It's an astute observation. And it's, I agree with John, too. Inexpensive energy has created the kind of society we have and what most of us probably consider to be benefits. But my personal fear is that energy prices are going to rise so quickly that we're not going to very easily be able to adjust. I mean, for years and years and years, we've watched crude oil prices. That was the big metric that we fretted over. Whereas coal, of course, which we use for power production, has stayed very stable. Well, in recent months, coal prices have doubled. They're building so many power plants in what used to be the third world that now we're shipping coal over there. And it's we ship stuff everywhere. One of my colleagues was recently talking at a graduate symposium about how he's working with one of the South American countries, and they're growing loblolly pine so quickly there. They can grow it so inexpensively that they put it on ships, send it to Florida, send it up to New York State, and then all the way across the country to Washington and British Columbia for construction. So what enables us to grow wood down there and move it two continents, cheap energy. Well, it's getting ready to change. My wife loves to shop at Trader Joe's, and she buys beans that are flown over here from France all the time. Well, I'm not sure I like them too. But a lot of changes that are going to come are going to be coming. So.